As kids, we can be fascinated by fairly gruesome things. Remember how many times you had to change a Band-Aid because you kept showing that gross cut or scab to all your friends? It is in that spirit that a pair of authors consider different ways to die in a book that somehow finds a line between funny and morose. The book is called And Then You're Dead. It is the work of Paul Dougherty, who brings the science mind to this partnership. He's the senior staff scientist at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good to be here, Jeffrey.
Good to have you. Cody Cassidy is the freelance writer and editor and University of Oregon journalism major involved with the project. Cody, good to hear from you.
That's right. Go Ducks.
So, Paul, the questions this book asks, are they often asked at the Exploratorium in San Francisco?
You bet. I work with children of all ages, from 4 years old to 85 years old and more. And in my job there, as senior scientist, I'll be walking the floor of the museum and someone will see my badge that indicates that I'm a staff member, and they'll say, you know, I've had this question I always wondered about, and they'll say, can magnetism kill you? And I said, oh, okay, let's see. No, mostly.
Well, let's start with that one, though, since you brought it up. I mean, because there is a reference in the book to, like, if there's a really gigantic fridge magnet. So, I mean, how gigantic would a magnet have to be to kill you, and how, other than crushing you against the refrigerator, I guess?
That's true, yeah. So on Earth, the strongest magnets we encounter are like MRI machines. If you've ever been in an MRI, that has a magnetism level of one. It's called one Tesla. And so that's pretty strong. And but out in space, there is a kind of star called a magnetar. And that's a spinning neutron star. And it has a magnetic field that is 100 billion times stronger than the MRI machine. And that magnetism is so strong that if you got within a few miles of the surface of that magnetar, it would take the atoms in your body and turn every atom into a long, thin, cigar-shaped thing instead of being like atoms should be, like spherical. And it would break all the bonds between all the atoms in your body and turn you into a plasma cloud shaped like a human. It would just rip you to shreds. But thank goodness, the nearest ones are tens of thousands of light years away, so we're saved. The magnetism is so strong, get this, if there was a magnetar located where the moon is, it would erase the magnetic stripe on every credit card on Earth.
Wow, that's a lot of strength. So we're glad the magnetars aren't that close. Okay, so that's one example of the things that can really happen. I should give you the full title of the book because it reads like this. What really happens if you get swallowed by a whale, are shot from a cannon, or go barreling over Niagara, and then you're dead? So the functioning title of the book is And Then You're Dead, or as the authors shorten it sometimes, A-T-Y-D. Cody, this book is, as you guys point out, like the pairing of two famous Stevens. Who would they be?
Yeah, at some point somebody pointed out that this was like a melding of Stephen Hawking and Stephen King as sort of their their brainchild, and that's sort of what we were going for. Thrilling, gruesome, but from a science perspective.
There's certainly a playful tone. Is the book written for kids though?
I would say it's written to be accessible. I think anybody who's you don't have to be a scientist to understand some really technical concepts that we go over, like the magnetism of your electrons and stuff. So anybody, really, any science level, I think, can learn something. I think Paul learned about the magnetism was sort of a breaking edge, cutting edge technology, really.
Out about the magnetar, I had to actually dig into recent PhD theses and scientific publications, and the equations in there were just horrendous, and I had to translate those into your atoms turn into cigars. You
know? That is a real skill, though. I mean, it's a great teaching thing to be able to turn something into, well, here's the actual force of the magnetar versus, like, here's what it would do to you.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I'm working with some teachers up there in the Jefferson neck of the woods. The state of California now has the Exploratorium working with high school and middle school teachers around the state, and we bring them down to the Exploratorium. And also then connect with them electronically and try to make science interesting, relevant, fun, and correct. Because if they can inspire their students with an exciting or interesting or gruesome idea, the students will then put in the work themselves that it takes to understand some of these concepts. So the book is just an extension of what I do in my everyday life.
You mentioned having learned some things yourself for the book, Paul. So, I mean, would this have been a very different book 20 years ago? I mean, do we know that much more over the past couple of decades?
Absolutely. I mean, science is making breakthrough after breakthrough. We had no idea there were magnetars 20 years ago. We had no idea there were gravitational waves until 2 years ago when they finally detected them. Now, it turns out we looked into, can gravitational waves kill you? And the answer appears to be no. All they do is make an annoying buzz in your eardrum. And that's when you're really close. But so we didn't make it into the book because it couldn't kill you. But we couldn't even talk about it 20 years ago.
So that was the benchmark. If something can't kill you, that doesn't go into the book?
That's right. That's right. And if it's not funny,
well,
forget
we
that.
Did. sometimes it was. We did ones that were surprising that they didn't kill you.
That's
I would
true.
Say the insomnia was one that was really fascinating. It seems there was a high school student that went 264 hours. His name was Randy Gardner, that went without sleep. And he hallucinated a few things. I think he hallucinated that a stop sign was a pedestrian. But it turns out he was cured with just a long nap. Right? So I think insomnia cannot kill somebody.
Well, it's interesting that you do actually provide a couple things from two different angles, because there is the one you just mentioned, what would happen if you couldn't fall asleep? And then several pages later, there's what would happen if you just stayed in bed? And
yeah.
So what would be the issues with just staying in bed, aside from the fact that, well, there are some eating and bathroom issues to consider?
Yeah, so I was just in the hospital for a while, and while I was there, these three nurses came in, and there was a senior nurse and a couple of beginning nurses, and they were there to inspect me for bed sores. And so while they were doing that, I got to say, hey, you know, I just wrote a book about how bed sores can kill you. And they were like, really? Oh, wow, tell us about that. So they were really interested in bed sores. But bed sores are nasty things. I mean, essentially, you get this pressure on normally, you are in bed and you roll around and you move. But sometimes you might be sedated or you're in painkillers. And so you can have one place in your body get pressure on it. It stops the circulation. You can't fight a slight infection there because you don't have circulating blood with the antibodies in them, and so they can be deadly. So you really, if you're sedated or in bed, you better watch out and have those, like those three nurses coming in to take care of me, there to take care of you, and they were impressed that anybody that they just walked up to check for bed sores had just written a chapter on death by bed sores.
That would be an unusual circumstance, certainly. But there are a lot of unusual circumstances in the book. The book is called And Then You're Dead. It's by Cody Cassidy and Paul Daugherty. Cody is a freelance writer and editor and a University of Oregon journalism major. Paul Daugherty is the senior staff scientist at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. If you have some questions about unique ways to die that you have to pose to our guests, join the conversation at 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, all right, let's run through some of these. What do you mean if you actually shook someone's hand? What would happen if you actually shook someone's hand? What we're not shaking people's hands when we shake them?
So it turns out our atoms are, electrons rotate around our atoms, and they have a little bit of negative charge. And so when you touch somebody else, you really never touched anything because they repulse so strongly that you can't quite get there. But we figured out that if you, the way that physicists do this is they build an atomic bomb around these. it takes so much pressure. It happens in the center of stars, too, that atoms actually touch, but there's so much pressure. So we figured out if you shook hands with somebody within an atomic bomb, your atoms would touch.
Not recommended. Do not attempt this at home.
Don't try it at home. And it actually would have disastrous results on top of the atomic bomb because atoms touching creates this sort of fusion.
Yeah, so it's nuclear fusion. So there are many hydrogen atoms in your body, and of course inside the center of the sun, the pressure and temperature is so great that the nuclei are stripped bare. There's none of those electrons around to keep them apart, and so the two hydrogen nuclei can get pushed together and eventually create something called deuterium, and then create tritium, and then keep going, and eventually you end up with four hydrogen atoms turning into a helium. And that's nuclear fusion. It's transmutation of the elements. and it's happening inside the sun. And if you actually shook someone's hand strongly enough that you pushed the electrons out of the way and the hydrogens came together, you could trigger nuclear fusion. And it's a tremendously strong energy source. I mean,
so a warm handshake, you're saying?
Yeah. So that would be a really memorable handshake.
No doubt. All right, let's move on to the chicken running around with its head cut off story. Is there something to that? Have chickens run around for more than just a few minutes with their heads missing?
Yeah, so there's this famous chicken, Mike the Headless Chicken, and the farmer went out to make dinner, and the chicken was wiggling around, and so when the farmer brought the hatchet down to cut off the head of the chicken, he cut off the head. I mean, you can actually see videos of this online. Look at Mike, the headless chicken. And so there's this neck and a chicken body running around in the yard. And it turned out the farmer had missed just a little tiny chunk at the base of the brain called the brain stem. And the brain stem controls breathing and eating. And he found that he could feed the chicken with a little eyedropper. And so he toured the country with Mike, the headless chicken, lived for years. Until, alas, it finally choked on a kernel of corn. Oh, well. But without a head, it's hard to cough, you know.
Yikes. there was a great sense of delicious macabre to the book, and then you're dead. And we're talking to the authors, Cody Cassidy and Paul Doherty. So there's actually a couple of almost human versions of the headless chicken. Talk about the student that was noticed by John Lorber in England.
Yeah, we were sort of wondering how useful the brain really is. And there's a medical patient that had a remarkably large head. And so his professor decided to take a look at it. And what they found was that inside his head was mostly filled with fluid. In fact, like just the outer crust of his brain was left. I think 5% of his brain matter was left. But he was a college student with an IQ of 126. So we were left wondering, maybe the brain isn't as important as we all thought it was.
Or at least parts of the brain. He had his brain stem, and he had like 5%. You know, they tell you only think with 10% of your brain. This guy only had 5% of his brain, and he had an IQ of 126. I mean, hey.
Wow, so his brain had just figured out all the wiring around the parts that were missing? Or did he have all the parts, just not in great multitudes?
Yeah, so it turns out your brain is really flexible. And if one part of the brain gets destroyed, sometimes other parts can take up the slack, especially if it happens since birth. I mean, essentially, you're born with this disease called hydrocephalus, where water, fluid, goes in and it begins to push on your brain and replace your brain. And but through time, your brain develops, and different parts of the brain that do exist take over the roles of the parts of the brain that were missing. So brains are just totally amazing, and that's one of the great things I learned while doing this book, is I had no idea that someone could live with 5% of a brain.
That is pretty, that was really, and then it goes on to the story of the railroad worker we probably heard about before who had the tamping rod blow up through his head, and he lived for many years after that, but he was a lot crankier apparently after that. Let's move on from the brain to the stomach, though, and get into the what would happen if you ate as many cookies as the Cookie Monster.
Yeah. So it turns out there was an experiment done on a stomach early in the 1900s.
Cadaver.
On a cadaver, yes. not a person. And they figured a stomach can hold about 4 liters before it pops.
They actually did that. They filled the stomach with 4 liters of liquid and it blew up.
So we added up 4 liters worth of cookies is probably about 60 regular sized chocolate chip cookies. So we think at about 59 or 60, the stomach would reach its limit. And if the stomach sort of looks like a kidney bean, and the inner part of the part that bends in would split right there along the seam and spill all these cookies throughout your innards, which would unfortunately be fatal.
Yeah, if you've ever seen that Monty Python movie where the guy has one thin mint and explodes.
The meaning of life, yes.
Meaning of life. It's not going to reach that stage. The explosion of your stomach will be contained inside of you, but it's still going to be fatal, and then you'll die.
Okay, so there we go. There's the name of the book almost, and then you're dead. What really happens if you get swallowed by a whale or shot from a cannon or go barreling over Niagara? So let's talk about Niagara Falls. Can you survive that fall over the falls in a barrel or something else?
Many people have, but it has been lethal for some of them. One of the things is, you go over the falls in a barrel, and if you were actually hitting water from the height of Niagara Falls, if there's just honest to God water, that you'd stop so abruptly that deceleration would almost certainly kill you, just a few percent chance of surviving. However, Niagara Falls, the water coming down is stirring up the water below and adding a lot of air to it. So as they used to say, it's too thick to breathe and too thin to drink. Because it's air-filled water. And when the barrel comes over, if it misses the rocks and it goes into the aerated water, it gives you a more gentle stop, which you can survive. But then the problems continue, because that falling water sets up a circulation where the barrel goes down and then it circles around and comes back up again. And one of the guys got trapped in that circulation for so many hours that he ran out of air and suffocated.
Oh, yikes.
But, yeah. Not recommended.
But the one guy survived, traveled around the world with his barrel, making money, except in New Zealand, he was walking down the street, having survived going over Niagara Falls, and he slipped on a fruit peel and cracked his skull and died several days later. So,
in fact, well, you do deal with the banana peel in the book as well. So, I mean, you can slip and fall. What is the goo in the banana peel that makes it so slippery?
There's a fluid. What is it?
It's a gel. You squeeze, take a banana peel and get a vise, maybe in your garage. Squeeze that banana peel in the vise, and this gel will come out of it. And that gel is extraordinarily slippery. It's twice as slippery as wet ice. And so if you're walking along and you hit a banana peel with that slipperiness, there's a 90% chance that you will end up on the ground. And from a 6-foot height, a human head striking the ground from 6 feet, actually, or even from 3 feet, is enough to crack your skull open.
Wow. That's a lot of velocity.
That's why people sort of sacrifice arms and broken wrists, and you automatically throw whatever you can down on the ground to sort of keep your head from hitting. Watch out for those banana peels.
Absolutely. We get to some notable extremes in here. I mean, we're talking about things like oxygen starvation or what could happen if you could stand on the sun. We also get into extreme cold as well. You do get into cryogenics in the book. Why can't we be frozen when we're ill and thawed when medical science and theory catches up with our illness?
Well, yeah, when you're frozen with liquid nitrogen, it turns out the reason you can't be revived is it freezes so fast that your cells remain intact. But there's no way to unfreeze you fast. You have to sort of thaw out slowly. And in that thawing out process, the water grows these spikes within your cells, and it sort of spears your own cells. So if you're cryogenically frozen, there's really no way to heat you up safely, at least right now.
Okay, so we're still working on that one. But wow, the icy spikes that really basically destroy your cells then, either in the freezing
right.
or the unfreezing.
Yeah, they can do it with individual cells like sperm or eggs, human eggs, one cell like that. They can freeze it and thaw it fast enough you can avoid that creation of those spikes. But with a human brain or an entire hand, they just can't warm it up rapidly enough to avoid that the formation of the spikes that pierce the cell membrane and you leak to death.
Oh, boy. So it's kind of like the reason we like fresh, not frozen
from
the supermarket.
Yeah,
okay,
right.
Yeah. So here's the big one from childhood, because I remember even DC Comics weighed in on this one. We think you could survive outside of a spaceship for at least a few seconds. Can you?
Yeah, you could right about 15 seconds before... whether you held your breath or not is the problem, because if you stepped out into a vacuum, the lack of pressure would suck out the air from your lungs. So it really wouldn't matter whether you went out there with a full breath or not. And then after that, it's about sort of 15 seconds before your brain runs out of oxygen and you would pass out, which is a good thing, because next would come in a vacuum. Unfortunately, the water boils at body temperature, so your blood would start to boil and you'd sort of start to swell up like in Arnold Schwarzenegger in Total Recall, I think it is, which they actually have pretty accurate. And then you'd be sort of a frozen human space balloon out there.
Yikes. So let's deal with what actually has happened to people in space, though, for our final venture here, which is we had this in an earlier book about space travel. What does the full garn mean among people who've gone into space?
Well, yeah, so Jake Garn, senator, managed to get himself a space trip. You know, that's what you can do as a senator. And but it turns out he was extraordinarily sensitive to space sickness. And so they actually, NASA set up a scale, the Garn scale, which was how sick did someone get when going into space? Going to zero gravity, like when you're on a roller coaster and you go up over the top and your stomach kind of comes loose and you feel kind of dizzy. And then if you've eaten cotton candy before you do that, the cotton candy comes up. Well, that was the full Garn experience, and so that's the ultimate level of space sickness.
So Senator Jake Garn left his mark on space travel in a way he never intended, that's for sure.
That's right.
All right.
Sometimes you get what you ask for.
All right. The book is a really, well, you can actually be fun and talk about the strange ways you could die in the universe all in one book. And I suspect there's probably more than enough for a sequel here. The full title is What Really Happens If You Get Swallowed by a Whale, Are Shot from a Cannon, or Go Barreling Over Niagara, And Then You're Dead. So you can look for the book on the shelves by And Then You're Dead. Cody Cassidy, freelance writer and editor and University of Oregon journalism major, is the principal writer. Paul Doherty is the senior staff scientist at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great. Great to be here.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right. Good to have you both.